You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We must be strong, smart and hard-headed, and we must demonstrate the resolve necessary to stand up for our interests.
British Prime Minister Theresa May brings the firm but fair as she meets President Donald Trump. How special is the special relationship, really? My guests Andrew Tuck and Henry Rhys Sheridan will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the UK Labour Party begins eating another helping of itself as it struggles to find a role in Brexiting Britain. The depressing metaphor for the state of the world that is the awarding of a major design prize to a flat-packed home for refugees, and dogs on a plane. Is it any better an idea than snakes? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle 24 associate producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan. Welcome both. Now, as we go to air, UK Prime Minister Theresa May is due to begin a joint press conference with US President Donald Trump. She is the first foreign leader to participate in such a production. Unusually for such an event, it is impossible to make assumptions about what might end up being said. Even as we speak, Trump might be complaining that the light makes him look fat or declaring war on the moon. We will be discussing this in the studio in just a moment, but first to our New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker. Ed, how much interest are the US media paying to Theresa May? They've had a fairly eventful week.
Yes, I mean, Trump has dominated in one form or the other, as you might expect, and I guess this is a continuation of that domination. But there has been so much, including the March for Life, at which Mike Pence spoke, the first sitting vice president to speak at this type of rally ever. Of course, we have the clash, if you like, between Mexico and the US. So there's quite a lot to knock this meeting off the front pages of the newspapers here in the US. Having said all of that, I think a lot will emerge. There'll be more interest once we know the full detail of what's going to take place at this joint press conference to which you alluded. I think, there's been quite a lot of interest in, I guess, how these two are going to team up and are teaming up. We've just seen television pictures a few moments ago of them standing rather awkwardly together, Theresa May looking rather awkward and Donald Trump doing his kind of a shoulder wobble that he does when he looks a bit nervous. She is being painted by the US press as being this sort of I don't know if calm is the right word, but this more demure character, the daughter of a vicar, someone who doesn't take to social media to voice her opinions. So at the moment, a lot being drawn about the difference in character between these two people and the fact that, given the speech that she made yesterday in Washington, the fact that she is clearly extremely keen to revive the so-called special relationship, even in the vein of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, that seems like a bit of a stretch of the imagination, but also, despite the fact that everything's been clouded by politics, keen to hammer out a trade deal for the UK in light of Brexit. I guess Donald Trump, who continues to divide opinion, not just nationally, but very much so internationally, keen to kind of get a first meeting with an international leader under his belt and come out of that in a positive light, I guess.
Ed Stocker in New York, thank you very much for joining us. Back to the studio, Andrew Tuck. Theresa May said yesterday that the US and the UK, as she put it, must renew the special relationship for this new age. Do we, or indeed she, have any idea what she actually meant by that?
I'm not sure. The special relationship, indeed, has been questioned what exactly that is for, I think, ever since that phrase was first coined. Although Mr. Trump is rather keen on it for lots of reasons. He wants to support this idea of Europe dissembling. He likes the fact that she represents a government that is going to bring about Brexit.
He owns a golf course in Scotland.
Exactly. He makes much of his his heritage here and his heritage in Europe. He likes the fact that she is a patriot, and he likes the fact that she talks tough on immigration. So I think there is, maybe that's not enough for a special relationship, but I think that there is certainly something in their mindset which is oddly and weirdly aligned.
That's a perplexing thought. Henry, speaking, if you will, on behalf of all 60-odd million of your fellow country folk, is it possible that Theresa May is... And you know, obviously, I think any UK Prime Minister, you have to go and visit the new US President. That's just reality. But is she running any domestic political risk by being seen to get too close to Donald Trump, who I think it's fair to say is not terrifically well-liked in the United Kingdom?
I'm loath to say that I'm going to say a few words in defence of May, but I do think that her speech that she gave yesterday in particular, I'm not sure how this is going to be reflected in her meeting today with Trump, but it wasn't uncritical, or at least she didn't toe the line Trumpology completely. She did advocate for a moderate but engaged foreign policy, certainly not the isolationism which we've at least come to attribute to Trump. And she also said that she was standing before the audience, a Republican audience, as a fellow conservative. And I see that as a nod to the more conventional, more classical conservatives in the Republican Party, excuse me. Trump certainly can't be counted among them. It's also worth pointing out, I think, that I think in its tone, at least, her attitude towards Trump is no more embarrassing than Brown and Cameron's pandering to Obama in 2009. So to a certain extent, I do think that her comments have to be judged in context. A degree of sucking up is par for the course.
Andrew, elaborating on that thought, how far, I mean, there is quite a common delusion, fantasy, it may even have some basis in truth among post-war British prime ministers, that they are a sort of wiser, more temperate influence on US presidents. We've seen this with Macmillan and Kennedy, with Thatcher and Reagan, with Blair and Bush. Does Theresa May think she can have that effect on Donald Trump to the extent that that's even possible?
Well, the strange prism that we're watching this through, and to be fair, it's not a British one, is it keeps on coming out from the US. Newt Gingrich seems to have been kind of obsessing all week about Margaret Thatcher. And I think that
I don't think it's just this week for Newt Gingrich.
But every time he's interviewed, it's like, Thatcher this, Thatcher that. And when I look at the US press this week, you know, certainly that reference, that idea has been, you know, brought up again and again. And I think there was a special relationship in the sense that they really did understand each other. There were many disagreements. I mean, as their papers have come out, we can see that they didn't always believe the same things. You know, for example, Thatcher was utterly opposed to the reunification of Germany, whereas Reagan wasn't. But when it came down to, you know, what should be done to terrible communists, they had the same idea. And I think here, again, when I go with this idea of patriotism, I think that there will be a bit of a lining between the two. Again, I think they do believe some of the same things. But I agree with Henry that, you know, it would be impossible for her to go there and say, look, your pussy snatching comment wasn't right. I'm a woman, I don't like it. That's not her job in this instance. And, you know, and she may have many private feelings about many of the things he'd said about women, about society, about other countries, or even how he's dealing currently with Mexico, that she disagrees with. She can't say that now. But the thing is, we've watched him for 3 days. He is going to make a monumental, terrible decision in the coming weeks, without doubt. He's like a TV junkie sitting up late at night who then has the power to go and act on all his grudges and foibles. And we've seen him do it day after day. It's going to go horribly wrong. And she has rushed in to, you know, attach her name to his. And that's where it's tricky for her. The British public don't like him. He represents lots of things that even in a moved to the right society, people find absolutely unpalatable. And she has properly staked her claim to be like him. And that is where it will 100% go wrong for her.
One thing that I do you think makes this different from previous similar meetings is that it's the first time it's happening post-Brexit. This is going to obviously place it under a more intense microscope, the microscope of the leaders of the EU, than previous meetings. Emmanuel Macron, the French presidential hopeful, has already said that the UK could turn into a vassal state of the US if it isn't careful. So she has that to deal with.
It's the sort of thing the French say to Britain all the time, in fairness.
Yeah, but yeah, again, yeah, of course it is. And you can look on the right and everyone's like, oh, because they speak English, you know, the Americans have more in common with us culturally. But you only have to just look what they've said about NATO over the last few days. The government of Donald Trump, the cabinet of Donald Trump, they don't understand what it feels like to be a European. And I think, oddly, you know, although we've walked away from the EU, I think that actually when it comes down to it, you know, the kind of values that Europeans have, the way that they see the world, the shared history they've got, is that often a bit tighter than you would imagine. And I think that, you know, what maybe Macron says isn't correct. But I think that she is wrong to think that the Americans are all like us. Actually, yeah, they speak English and many of them have the same faith and they watch the same TV shows. But actually, Americans are rightfully very different people to Brits, and actually Brits are different to, you know, Germans and French, but it doesn't mean that we don't actually have at the end of the day often more in common because of the size of our countries, the way they run together, with Europeans.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at the UK, where observers of British politics are once again dusting off their shadow cabinet resignation bingo cards. Another mutiny against embattled, if not downright beleaguered, leader Jeremy Corbyn seems afoot, following his insistence that party MPs back the Article 50 bill, which will launch the UK's egress from the EU. The shadow ministers for early years and Wales, respectively Tulip Sadiq and Joe Stevens, have quit, and several other MPs, including two whips allegedly responsible for maintaining party discipline, have declared their intention to vote against it. Andrew, leaving aside the question of Jeremy Corbyn and his competence to lead, even if anybody else was in that job, would Brexit have completely stuffed Labour? Do they have any good play to make?
He is in a very, very difficult spot. And what he's trying to do is appease the voters in very kind of in constituencies where they're borderline UKIP, where they might go jump to the far right. So in constituencies,
including upcoming by-election in Stoke.
Exactly. So in places where he thinks they could lose to UKIP, he knows that the only message that he can say to those people, and that this is white working class voters who, you know, traditionally have been Labour, who felt left down because, you know, Labour was seen to be the kind of, you know, the anti-London, anti-big government party, that the Tories were stymied by that. So those voters would have been Labour voters. They're traditionally, you know, they're moving, it seems, across to UKIP. He wants to stop that. In those constituencies, the only thing he can do is say, okay, we 100% will carry out your wishes. The trouble is that the Labour Party has always been, you know, split between North and South, and between a kind of North London, Hampstead lefty voter and the coal miner and the industrial worker. And for generations, it managed to somehow mix all these people in together. It's proving increasingly difficult. And here in London, you have a range of MPs, for example, who know that their constituency has voted often by like 80-odd% plus to remain within the EU. So there's a fascinating pecking order when you're an MP. You know, do you act on what you actually wholeheartedly deep down believe? And there should be hopefully some issues that you would never vote against your conscience, your belief in, no matter what your constituency, your party said. Do you answer to your constituency? And I would say yes. The people who properly voted for you, that's who you answer to. Or do you answer in the end to the bigger party and their demands? And I'd say, you know, in the end, you know, you can be whipped and you can be forced to go along with something, But if you let down your constituents, then you're nothing as an MP. And I think the MPs who are saying that they're going to ignore this and go with what their constituents want are correct.
Henry, this is, as Andrew delineates there, an interesting test case for the hierarchy of loyalties for any elected representative, because there are Labour MPs who favoured staying in the EU whose constituencies wanted to leave. There are constituencies such as the one I live in, which is a Labour constituency, which was very, very much Remain, but whose MP is very much Leave. How should you prioritise it? If you're going into this vote on Article 50 as any given MP, and you have a conflict between what your party leader wants, what your constituents want, and what you want, who wins?
Zooming out, I think, from the UK context, and just looking at the question in abstract a bit more broadly, which is, you know, do politicians represent the nation or the local constituency or themselves or some other nefarious business interest? The problem is, I think, in answer to this question, I think Andrew would have a difficult time applying the principle that one should always represent one's constituents first in a broader context. Sometimes representing your local constituents can actually be against not only the national interest, but, you know, the interests of more vulnerable groups in society. In the US, famously, pork barreling happens, so it's called, where, you know, you'll get local politicians trying to channel, sometimes artificially manipulate government contracts so that it brings work to their local constituencies.
And quite often things they can name after themselves.
Exactly. And I think another thing to point out is that, you know, obviously we're speaking in a relatively liberal room, I think it's safe to say, in the context of a politician acting on wanting to remain in Europe. If you look over to America, what we, I think, are likely to see in the next few years with Donald Trump is local politicians, perhaps local politicians in areas where their constituents are largely in support of Trump's policies, refusing to go along with some of the policies which are most egregious. Now, that is an example of a politician, a local politician, disagreeing with their constituents, and it's one that we would probably applaud. It's very difficult to apply this principle consistently.
So there's an MP here, Chris Bryant, who represents a constituency in the Rhondda, and I saw something he said the other day on his Facebook page to his constituents, and he said, I'm a firm Remainer. I will always, to my dying day, be a Remainer. But you voted to leave, and I'm going to do everything I can to make the process work for you. I have lost this battle. I will do what you want. There's an MP answering to his constituency. I think that, you know, I understand if there had been a pledge in the manifesto when you were elected that said, you know, that we are a party of Leave, then you must go along with it. And if you were elected on that ticket, that's fine. But this wasn't the case. Here are MPs who were elected mainly on a Remain proposal. Now they're being asked to change their minds halfway through and to be whipped into all doing exactly the same thing. And also, I was just going to say, hold on, we have a guy, Jeremy Corbyn, who made his miserable career a name through being an absolute grumpy old bugger who would never do what Tony Blair wanted. Well, would just disagree with everything. And now, that's why he's, you know, one of the numerous reasons he's an utter disaster, is he has no moral authority to go to anyone and tell them what to do. It's none of his business.
It was once calculated, with all due deference to the length of his political career, that he had literally voted against Labour more often than David Cameron had.
I think one thing that it is safe to say about the political context in which we're moving, perhaps reluctantly, on the part of many people, is that it really is going to throw up fundamental questions about the mechanisms of representative democracy. When you have things such as, you know, the weird irregularities in the Electoral College and what's going on in Europe, you know, there's going to be some serious questions raised.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Andrew Tuck and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Coming up next, the Design Museum names its design of the year.
A new year is upon us and a fresh issue of Monocle is hitting the newsstand. Eager to start the year as we mean to go on, we've packed the February issue full of ideas for how to make our cities and our lives healthier, smoother, and, well, just better. In our 100th issue, we take a whistle-stop tour of three cities designed for healthy living, offer up some lessons, courtesy of a group of Dutch nuns, on how to learn a new foreign language, and we discover the smartest methods out there for making cities safer. The February issue of Monocle will have you shaking off any final vestiges of holiday slumber and sprinting into 2017 well-informed and suitably inspired. Monocle's February issue. Buy your copy today. Happy reading.
And you're back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Andrew Tuck and Henry Rees Sheridan. Now, the Beazley Design of the Year, now in its ninth year, is one of the harder awards to pick. By definition, almost anything useful, constructive, progressive, or merely well-wrought can be considered, leading to diverse fields of nominees. This year, the judges considered a robot surgeon, a coffee cup for astronauts, and the artwork for David Bowie's final album, before settling on IKEA's contribution to the world's various refugee crises, a flat-packed polymer temporary home assemblable, if that is indeed a word, in just 4 hours with an anticipated lifespan of 3 years. Andrew, we should probably rise above all jokes about how anyone with experience of IKEA furniture will think that the 3 years might be nearer the time it's going to take to build the thing. But how? I mean, it is an amazing design. It's an extraordinary thing. It is made of polymer. It is insulatable. It can be erected in 4 hours. It's not terrifically expensive, but does this design, or does the award to this design, seem somewhat wretchedly emblematic?
No, I think all credit to IKEA, as I used to call it. We're now being told by the adverts to call it IKEA, as the Nords do.
That's never going to catch on.
But they're having a good go. What's interesting is, so the likes of IKEA or IKEA, and the likes of Muji, they're very, very good at affordable mass production. Now, we know that that can be used for, you know, producing, you know, lots of nice things for our home, from like wonky bookshelves to, you know, cheap kitchens. But when it comes to something like this, how amazing that they have put their skills and their efforts behind this. And actually, they're a very interesting company, because they have, over the last few years, they've increasingly worked with interesting design people. They have a sustainability chain, which is really, really amazing how much they test every single product all the way along the line to make sure there's nothing that they can get in trouble for. So here's a company that kind of wants to do good. And we always talk about, you know, people's, you know, corporate social responsibility programs, and, you know, the fact that they let executives have off, you know, a day a month to go and, you know, I don't know, clean out the local fish pond, whatever. But here is a company doing genuinely good things. And I think many of the things I read about this project and the hut, as it were, you know, were interesting. But one of the best things I read was just a simple thing which made me think how important it would be to me if I was in that situation. It's safe and secure. You can lock it. Now, if you're given a tent and the wind is billowing and you shut a zip and maybe put a tiddly padlock on it and you leave the last of your possessions in a refugee camp and you wander off to get water, who knows whether it'll be there when it comes back. Here's a little hut that you have a unique piece of dignity. You have the dignity to lock it and go away in the secure knowledge that when you come back, your possessions will be there. Now, of all the things that we take for granted at the end of the day, you know, running water, heat, which this also does help provide, I thought that was the one human dignity. And if it's only that they had managed to deliver to people, then I would applaud them.
It is no small change. It did strike me that it seems weird that it's taken this long for somebody to think of it. I mean, I've spent some time reporting from refugee camps, and it is exactly that. You sort of think, is this really the best we can do, as you look at all these rows of flimsy tents?
Not only that, but I also think, in asking your first question as to whether or not this prize is wretchedly emblematic, I think you're aiming at the wrong target here. For me, the pertinent question is, how did it fall on a less than sexy Scandinavian flat pack furniture company working in some kind of bizarre brand collaboration with the UN to invent this, and not one of the wealthier sovereign states in which these refugees are arriving?
I'll tell you why, Henry, because they'd be crap at it. That's why. That, you know, if you want to build a piece of affordable housing, go to somebody who knows how to do it. And that's where all these, you know, these do-good systems go wrong is, you know, some kind of charity employs a super expensive architect who says they'll do the work for free and comes up with some concept. And yeah, they create something that takes maybe like 4 weeks to put up and costs, you know, £20,000 per unit. And I've seen these things. I see these solutions rolled out again and again and again. Yeah, all nice, very hard to maneuver around, very hard to produce cheaply. You need to go to the people who know how to do it. And how clever they went to, okay, somebody finally thought, who can do something for the home that's about living, that's an environment that has some interest in sustainability and can whack these things out cheaply? There's no better place and this is where, you know, when we talk about, you know, the role of, you know, public private, here's an ideal example where actually it should be pushed onto the private.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we move on to Dogs on a Plane, not a cuddly Disney sequel to the well-loved Samuel L. Jackson kitsch classic, but an initiative by Japan Airlines. This week, a JAL 737 departed from Narita on a special three-day tour, including hotels and sightseeing, on which dog owners were permitted to have their pets in the cabin. This follows last year's launch of a similar service by ANA. Andrew, you are, of course, a dog owner. Is it fair to take them on a mode of transport in which they can't stick their heads out the windows?
I am somebody who has Googled quite a lot to see whether an airline accepts a dog on the plane rather than in the hold. First of all, I'd never put my dog in the hold of a plane. I think it's a miserable process and it would never allow it to happen. But actually, I'm not sure that I would, one, trust my dog to be on a plane. So noise may kind of bark and yelp, I think. But actually, it's a small enough dog to kind of sit on my lap, would probably be reasonably happy. I think could be made reasonably sure that on a short flight I didn't want to have a wee midair, but I couldn't guarantee it. And the idea that I'd be mortified if anything like that happened. But increasingly, dogs are getting on planes, whether these airlines like it or not. We've just had a case that's being taken through the courts here in the UK where British Airways is going to be sued by a woman, an American woman, who said that she arrived at the airport with her two dogs. And BA wouldn't let her get on the plane with her two dogs because they said they didn't take dogs in the cabin. She said, well, they're my comfort dogs. I've got proof from my doctor that I will have a panic attack if I'm not allowed to get on the plane with the dogs.
There was a comfort duck story a while ago as well.
Yeah, and the BA said you can't get on. So then apparently she collapsed on the floor and did have a panic attack. So anyway, she's now suing them. In America, there was an amazing piece in The New Yorker last year about comfort animals where a woman managed to take a pig on a plane. So she was very clever. She was a great journalist. She took a llama to a museum. She took a snake to Chanel. She took a pig on a plane. And all she had to do was have a fake certificate she'd printed off proving that she would be in distress without it. So I think dogs I'm unsure about, but I did. I think I may have sat next to a pig on a plane, but not.
I was on a flight between Palermo and Rome a couple of years ago, in which somebody brought on a small yapping dog in a cage, which I could cheerfully have thrown overboard after about 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think in Europe it's allowed. So Tom Ford, famously, who when he was working for Gucci, he had with Air France a frequent flyer card for his dog, which had apparently more air miles than kind of most humans, and was allowed to sit next to him.
Can I make a modest proposal that
could
find a halfway house here? I think dogs should be scored, ranked somehow, based on an initial flying performance, and there should be a no-fly list for dogs, as there are for humans. If they, for example, in Andrew's case, are so irritable, sorry, the dog, not you, are so irritable to other passengers that they cause significant distress, or if they otherwise impede the flight in any way, they should be able to be banned. But if someone, you know, if a dog is perfectly personable on a flight, well-behaved, causes no more distress than any average human, why not?
I'm in favour of it as long as the dogs have to wear sort of World War One flying helmets with the goggles.
With the leather ones.
Yeah,
with
obviously.
The flapping behind,
sure. With the flaps.
Or maybe they could, like, deliver the drinks or something like that. That would be quite good.
Well, you do get canine ring bearers at weddings, don't they, where there's a kind of cushion on their back and you put the ring on there. So I can definitely imagine accepting a bag of nuts.
I'm not sure what kind of weddings you've been going to, Henry.
Haven't you heard about this?
No, not at all.
Interesting. Okay. I'll send you a link after.
Dogs can be trained to perform some basic tasks. They can use ATMs. They can, you know, they can operate domestic appliances. You could imagine a golden retriever sort of pushing the drinks cart down the...
Yeah, my dog, you can point your finger at it and say, dead, and it falls down dead.
Not sure if that would count as in-flight entertainment, but I mean...
Yeah, maybe the gun on a plane isn't so clever.
Sure.
Okay, the canine air crew thing, it's going to happen. Within a year, we are going to be talking about somebody actually doing that. Andrew Tuck and Henry Ree Sheridan, thank you for joining us on Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Helena Geriat, and Stephen Kenny. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next, 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.